Welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. I've been trying to work out when the Sydney Peace Prize actually started. I think it was in 1998. And many of the winners passed almost without comment. They were just so wonderfully respectable. Who could complain about Desmond Tutu or Sir William Dean or Mary Robinson? But once Hanan Ashrawi won in 2003, the critics of the prize started to get their knickers in a twist, much the same response to Arundhati Roy, to Hans Blix, who got it in 2007, John Pilger, my old friend, God, conniptions, and now it's gone to Noam Chomsky, and the right-wing commentariat are enraged. I don't think that worries Noam Chomsky too much, does it, Noam?
No, not particularly, unless there's something substantive. I pay attention.
But it seems to me that you're almost as immune to accolades as you are to criticism. You seem to brush it all off. I mean, you're frequently described as the most important intellectual alive. You don't blush when that's said?
Well, when people quote that, they never quote the next sentence. It was in the New York Times. The next sentence was something like, how can he write such terrible things about American foreign policy? That somehow never gets quoted in the press.
Well, it's on the record now.
Yeah, okay.
Now, this is about our 13th or 14th chat, and it's just wonderful to have you here. And let me add to this mountain of congratulations on the one hand, as opposed to the attacks on the other. You must have a groaning mantelpiece of...
Sorry?
You must have a mantelpiece groaning with prizes.
There's a pile somewhere, not a mantelpiece.
Look, in all the times I've talked to you, I've never had a chance to ask you a little bit about your extraordinary youth. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about William and Elsie.
About?
Your father and mother, William and Elsie.
My father was... they were both first-generation immigrants. My father came when he was about 17. He came in 1913 from the Ukraine. He came essentially to escape the Tsar's draft, which was almost a death sentence for Jewish boys. He lived in a village, which was later wiped out by the Nazis, nothing left. When he came to the United States, didn't know any English. He worked in a sweatshop in Baltimore, managed to get to learn the language, got some education, finally went to Johns Hopkins, got a degree, ended up a pretty important Hebrew scholar, did a lot of work on medieval Hebrew grammar. In fact, when I was a child, I was reading the draft of his dissertation on David Kimchi, a 13th century medieval grammarian. And he went on to be an educator, kind of a Deweyite educator, and... taught in a Hebrew college and then the graduate University of Jewish Studies in Philadelphia, Dropsy College. It's my father. My mother was also an immigrant. She came when she was a baby, about a year old, and she came from what's now Belarus. Family was in New York. Also, both families are extreme, super Orthodox. I mean, I remember my mother... telling me that when she was with her friends in the streets of New York, say a young teenager, if she saw her father coming towards them, they would cross the street because she didn't want to be embarrassed in front of her friends by having her father pass by and act as if he didn't recognize her, mere girl. You know, she was very smart, independent, but she couldn't go to college. That's only for boys. So her younger brother was allowed to go to college, but she could only go to normal school. She became a teacher, an educator, also Hebrew educator, wrote books. Actually, the two of us even wrote a play together once in Hebrew. But she became a pretty influential educator in the Hebrew, I wouldn't say, you know, ghetto isn't exactly the right word, but there was, where they lived in Philadelphia, where I grew up, there was a segment of the Jewish community, mostly first-generation immigrants, who were deeply engaged in revival of Hebrew, revival of the modernization of Jewish culture. They wanted to split from the diaspora tradition of Eastern Europe.
And split from Yiddish?
Yeah, both my parents, their native language was Yiddish, but they wouldn't let us hear a word. So all I learned of Yiddish was what everybody learns from Woody Allen or the secret language of your parents.
You drop the odd Yiddish word into your public performances, though, don't you?
Occasionally.
Yeah. So who influenced you the most politically, Mum or Dad?
Politically, really, neither. I mean, this is the 30s, so they were fairly conventional New Deal Democrats. I mean, I can remember listening to Roosevelt's fireside chats on Friday evening. I think Friday evening there was a kind of a mood of calm settling over the family. You know, everything's going to be okay. But the influences on me politically, to the extent they came from the family, came from a different part of the family. My mother's relatives were all in New York. New York's a short train ride from Philadelphia. By the time I got old enough to travel myself, about 11 or 12, I'd take the train to New York all the time, stay with a couple of my relatives, and they were working class mostly, most of them unemployed at the time, and there was a pretty lively, there was a very lively working class culture in the 1930s, it's sort of forgotten, but like my uncle, one uncle who was maybe the biggest influence on my life at that age, actually never went past fourth grade. And others had some education, but not much.
Your uncle was a Trotskyite, wasn't he?
He had been through every sect that there was and had rejected them all. So he wasn't he was an ex-Trotskyite, but an ex-everything else as well.
You were never seduced by the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, were you?
By the time I was about 12 years old, I was not only anti-Stalinist, but anti-Leninist from the left. And I was being led towards the anarchist movements and towards the left Marxists. I mean, there was a major component of the Marxist tradition, which was very critical of Bolshevism from the left. There was another one from the right, the Mensheviks, but there was an important one on the left. People like Anton Panikuk, who was one of the leading intellectuals of the social democracy, but a left critic of Bolshevism and others. And those are the people I read. And they were not too far from components of the anarchist movement. They were sort of close to the anarcho-syndicalists, who I was also interested in. I became very much interested in the Spanish Revolution right around the early, you know, around 1940, around that time.
Well, the impulse to write pretty much your first column or your first article when you were 10.
I don't know if it was the first one, but it was, yeah, an early one. I was the editor of the fourth grade newspaper, probably the only reader, except maybe for my mother, I don't know. But I did write an article, which I sort of half remember, right after the fall of Barcelona, so that would have been about February 1939. It wasn't specifically about the Spanish Civil War, it was about the rise of the spread of fascism in Europe, which seemed, as a child, it seemed very frightening and ominous. I mean, you know, I listened to Hitler speeches on the radio. I didn't understand anything, but you could pick up the mood and the threat and sort of knew some of the things that were happening. And the article was about the fall of Austria, then Czechoslovakia, now Spain. At the time, it looked as if fascism was unstoppable. It was going to spread over the world. It was frightening in itself, but it also had it tied in with personal experiences, which incidentally my parents never even knew about. Those days, you didn't talk to your parents about personal things. It's not, at least boys didn't. It's not done. But we lived in a neighborhood where we were the only Jewish family. And the neighborhood was pretty pro-fascist. Partly it was Irish Catholic, and they just hated the British. And partly it was German. They were pro-Nazi. But you know, as a boy in the streets, you get to run into these things. And I grew up with just a visceral fear of Catholics. I knew when the kids came out of the Catholic school down the street, they were going to be raving anti-Semites. And maybe later in the afternoon, they'd calm down. They could play ball or something. But it's just part of experience was fear of violently anti-Semitic, mostly Catholic kids coming from this Jesuit school. But,
well, with this momentum, with this background, why didn't you study politics when you went to university? Why did you suddenly opt for linguistics?
I didn't study politics because I really didn't believe in what was being taught. I thought I had better insight from other sources. And I, in retrospect, think that was probably a wise decision. And actually, I got into linguistics through political contacts. It's just a personal story. I don't know if it's of any general interest. But,
well, I'd love to hear it.
I went to a Deweyite experimental school. As I said, my father was very much interested in Dewey's educational theories and practiced them. It was run by Temple University Education Department, which happened to be Progressive Education Department. It was a terrific school. I was there from infancy, really, about 18 months old, since my parents worked, until high school, so until 12. And it was a very exciting experience. You weren't graded. There were no ranking. Actually, I didn't know I was a good student until I got into high school. I mean, I knew I had skipped a grade, but okay, this just meant I was the smallest kid in the class. Nobody paid any attention to it. The teachers kind of inspired creative work, often cooperative. You worked with other people or you just pursued your own interests. There was a curriculum. You followed it. And I can remember the school very well. Then I got into the academic high school. There's one academic high school in the city, actually two, one for boys, one for girls. My future wife went to the girls one. And it was kind of like a black hole. I don't remember a thing. Everything was graded. You had to pass exams. You know, everything was ranked. It was extremely boring. I was looking forward to going to college, the local college, of course. There's no thought of going anywhere else. You live at home, you work, you go to college. But and I looked, you know, I was 16 when I got into college, and the catalog looked very exciting. I was going to take courses in, you know, Greek, this, that, all kind of exciting stuff. When I started to take the courses, I discovered it's high school. You know, it's just, you know, boring, routine. And I was ready to drop out after about a year. I didn't see any point going on. And I happened to run into, through political contact, through left, what's now would be called anti-Zionist, then it was Zionist, left Zionist, anti-state, radical activism. I ran into a professor at the...
This is Zelig Harris.
Zelig Harris,
yeah.
Who was very much involved in these things. In fact, was at the center of many of these movements and had a big influence on a lot of young Jewish intellectuals at the period. He didn't write much, so nobody knows about it, but was very influential and kind of a charismatic person. I got to know him, and in retrospect, I think he was trying to convince me to get back into college. He didn't say anything, but he just suggested that I start taking some of his graduate courses. So I took them. And then
isn't life serendipitous?
Strange.
Absolutely arbitrary in a way, isn't it?
Well, the whole thing for me is totally so. I don't even have professional qualifications, which is why I'm teaching at MIT. They didn't care. But I had no professional qualifications in any field. Through Harris's influence, I started taking graduate... He directed me to faculty members at the university who were pretty exciting people, but in different fields. One was in mathematics, another in philosophy, and I ended up with a strange hodgepodge of
Well, you did pretty well because you finished up as institutional professor and professor emeritus of linguistic and philosophy at MIT, which isn't too bad for a sort of an autodidact.
It was serendipitous, you used to say. It's mostly accidental. When I got out of, I did go for 4 years of at Harvard graduate work, Society of Fellows, kind of a graduate sub-institution at Harvard for select students. And that was very free also. It was kind of like elementary school again. But when I was finished with that, I had no profession and I had no particular job prospects. And I had friends at MIT and they just suggested that I come to the electronic, I get a job in the electronics lab. I mean, I can't tell a radio from a tape recorder to this day. If I something goes wrong with my computer, I have to check with my grandchildren. But so I had an interview. The head of the research lab of electronics, a person became pretty well known, Jerry Wiesner. He became Kent Kennedy's science advisor shortly after. And we had an interview. He was interested, talked about what I was interested in. He thought it was interesting. He suggested that I work in a project that they had there on machine translation. And I told him I thought it was a silly project. I wasn't going to work on it. But the way to solve it was just brute force. There was nothing else he could do, which turned out to be correct years later. But he thought that was a pretty good answer. So he said, okay, why don't you just work on what you're interested in? And it kind of went on from there. But it was luck, you know. Otherwise, I would never have ended up in the academic world.
It's interesting that even if you had never made a public utterance on matters political, that you were going to be a trailblazer, because I vividly recall your great contribution, your great theoretical contribution to the notion of language, that it is innate and not learnt. And you argued, discovered, the role of hormones in the emergence of human language, in much the same way as hormones play such a part in the emergence of puberty.
Well, in a sense, that's correct. I mean, there was a kind of a general atmosphere in Cambridge, Mass, which was, it was all over the place, but in Cambridge it was kind of the peak. In philosophy, social sciences, psychology, linguistics, practically all fields, it was called behavioral science. There was a belief. It was an interesting period that in American life altogether, it was an interesting period. It's worth remembering that before the Second World War, the United States was far and away the richest country in the world, but it really wasn't a major player in world affairs. You know, Britain was the dominant power. And intellectually, it was kind of a backwater. If you wanted to study physics or philosophy or math, you went to Germany or England. If you wanted to be a writer, you went to Paris. You know, the United States was like Central Iowa. You wanted to get out if you wanted to do anything. So much so that after the Second World War, when I was teaching at MIT, we were still teaching French and German to the graduate students because as a holdover from the pre-war period, they had to know them because that's where the work was. After the Second World War changed all that dramatically. Power shifted to the United States. It became the major technological center, intellectual center. A lot of European emigres came. They, you know, they fled fascism. Europe was devastated. So there was a kind of a sort of a Rome-Greece attitude towards Europe. Yeah, it's there.
So faded, your personal timing was perfect, wasn't it?
Pardon?
Your personal timing was perfect.
Luck as luck had it. But it was more than that. I mean, there was a sense in the United States in the 50s, if you read back the literature then, that we can discard all of that old-fashioned stuff. That was all old European stuff. We're going to do it the right way. We're Americans. We'll do everything from scratch. And it had an objective basis. The United States at that time was, it had literally half the world's wealth and incredible security. And it was in a position to dominate the world, and planners knew it. There were careful plans laid for running the world. But in the intellectual spheres, and it was kind of at its peak in places like Cambridge, you know, Harvard, MIT, and so on, there was a sense that we can start everything all over. And there were a lot of new discoveries. The early 1950s, it was discovery of DNA. Okay, we've somehow, in the 1930s, there was, and it included a major American scientist, Linus Pauling, there was became possible to unify chemistry and physics with the new quantum theory. And that was a step forward. And during the war, a lot of technological development. Mm-hmm. After the war came, in the late 40s, information theory, which looked like could be a unifying concept for the human sciences. Then came radical behaviorism, Skinner's work, late 40s, that looked like kind of the answer to human behavior. A couple of years later came Crick and Watson, discovery of DNA. It looked as if somehow biology was going to be integrated into chemistry, which already somehow had a link to physics. And the concept of unified science, you know, we can unify all of science and march on, was very dominant.
It's still just beyond their reach, isn't it?
It's
been seen forever.
There's a lot more modesty now, and properly. In the human sciences, including linguistics, there was a sense that everything was basically solved, you know, with just kind of a few touches here and there, but the basic ideas are understood. The most influential philosopher of the period, it happened to be at Harvard, W.V. Quine, one of the very influential philosopher. His view was that, as he put it, language is essentially an arbitrary collection of conditioned responses. It's a fabric of sentences connected to one another and to stimuli by conditioned response and Skinnerian lines. And that was virtually dogma. That, together with information theory, you know, the computers were just coming along. It looked as if it would be possible to automate analytic techniques. That's where the machine translation interest came from. There were a couple of us, actually three grad students, who didn't believe a word of it at Harvard in the early 50s. And we tried to work out our own views. One of them died some years ago. He was the founder of Modern Biology of Language. Another is my office mate still after 60 years at MIT. He's retired also. But we thought, first of all, that with regard to language, that the core problems were just being ignored and not even studied. I mean, the most elementary property of language, when you think about it, and it was kind of understood in the 17th and 18th century, is that is a capacity which all humans share and no other organism has to act creatively with language, to produce an unbounded number of expressions which have very specific meaning and very specific sound, not determined by stimuli, either external or internal, appropriate to situations, not caused by them, intelligible to others who recognize that they could have expressed the same thought the same way that never occurred to them before, and it can go on without bounds. It's a kind of an elementary aspect of human nature, and a very distinctive one. If you go back to, say, Descartes, that was kind of the core of Cartesian philosophy, and it spread and found its way into all sorts of directions, like classical liberalism, much Enlightenment thought. A lot of it's been forgotten since, but it was quite real. Then it was forgotten in the 19th century, and the 20th century became turned into what I just described, kind of behavioral science, analysis of data, and so on. But it was missing all of these points.
And then the three of you come along, and?
Well, the three of us, you know, just a couple of other friends, you know, but it was mainly the three of us, thought, first of all, that this ought to be the core problem for the study of language. And the other thing we thought was that language should not be divorced from biology, that the capacity for language is a biological capacity, much like, say, the visual system or the immune system and so on, just some subsystem of the cognitive faculties, which should be studied, can be studied on its own, but also integrated with others. That later came to be called biolinguistics. And pursuing those two directions, a new approach to language and cognitive science sort of began to develop with in interaction with this around the same time. It's still a very conflicted. It's not that everyone accepts it by any means.
But I'm aware of that. Yeah. You are under constant attack in that area of your life, as you are, so as you are politically.
It's a contested area, but I think it. I don't really think there's much. Shouldn't be much controversy about it. But and out of that came, and then MIT just became the center of it. We were all at MIT, and one of us, Eric Lenneberg, went off to medical school and worked on biology of language. And Morris Halley is, as I said, still my office mate after all these years. And we developed a department, and students came and so on and so forth, spread all over the world.
And you were able to demonstrate quite convincingly that the capacity to learn language was at its greatest when the human being is pretty young.
It was kind of known intuitively, but as the topic became studied much more intensively, actually some of the best works done by a couple of scientists who are right here now, Stephen Crane and Ross Thornton, by now there's intensive study of acquisition of language, and like other biological capacities, it appears to have what's called a critical period. It functions almost reflexively at a certain stage of life. Later stages, it
gets damn sight harder, doesn't it?
It has to be done differently. Actually, there are individual differences, but it's generally true.
I'd like you to rest your weary voice for a minute while I identify the program. Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web. And my very, very voice-weary guest, because boy, have they been putting him through the media hoops, is, of course, Noam Chomsky. Okay, I asked you this years and years and years ago, but it's so long ago I can't quite remember the answer. But I think there was a time when there was a cluster of languages that you were finding a bit recalcitrant, a bit hard to sort of fit in. And those were some, at least some, of the Aboriginal languages in Australia.
Well, there was one of the early appointments in our department, Kenneth Hale, who became a very close friend. He died a couple of years ago. He was one of the founders of Australian Linguistics. In fact, a lot of the people working here now are students of his and so on. And he did a lot of work with Aboriginal languages of Australia, with Native American languages, later others. And some of them seemed to have properties which looked quite different from familiar Western languages. Actually, I should say, so did Japanese at the time. It looked quite different. One of the basic differences appeared to be, and right through the 1970s, this was widely assumed, that they were kind of they had free word order, basically.
Yeah,
kind of like Latin. Yeah. You know, you could put words in all sorts of orders, whereas a language like English, it's got to be pretty rigid. So it was assumed that there's a property, it's called a parameter, technically a distinction among languages, whether they're word order free or rigid word or fairly rigid word order. Over the years, there's been a lot of chipping away at that. It now appears, first it was shown for Japanese and others, it just wasn't true, that they had basically the same structures, a few differences, but not these. Finally, that came to be shown for every language that's known, including the ones that appeared to have extremely free word order. One of the main ones was Walbury, one of the languages that Ken studied. But more intensive study showed that if you looked more closely, they had pretty much the same principles. There are differences, but small differences. In fact, it's kind of interesting that the same development has taken place within biology. So if you go back to the 1950s, in the study of language, it was pretty widely assumed that languages can, I'm quoting virtually, that languages can differ from one another arbitrarily, almost without limit, and that when you approach a new language, you should approach it without any assumptions about what the structure of language should be. That's sometimes called the Boasian tradition, after the great anthropologist Franz Boas. Biology, the same was assumed. It was assumed that organisms can vary from one another virtually without limit, and they develop the way they do just by the accidents of natural selection over long periods. Both of these ideas are pretty much, well, in biology it's gone. By now it's so far gone that there are even proposals taken seriously, even if not totally accepted, that there may be a universal genome that all complex or multicellular organisms developed roughly 500 million years ago, Cambrian explosion, and they're all fundamentally the same, from bacteria to humans. They have slight difference. What's been found is conservation of genetic mechanisms, which is extremely deep, and the way it was put back in the 1970s by one of the great figures who initiated this development, François Jacob, was that great French biologist, Nobel laureate, that, as he put it, the difference between, say, an elephant and a fly is just a slight differences in the arrangement of regulatory mechanisms.
Everyone can see that, no.
Yeah, that's right. But, and this went in parallel with similar developments in linguistics, not unrelated, incidentally. We all knew each other, and there was influences.
But what an exhilarating time it must have been for
you. It's quite exciting, yeah. By now, what seemed very exotic in the early 50s for many, not for everyone by any means, but for at least people in a pretty wide sector of study of mind seems kind of routine. Yeah.
Are the studies in linguistics plateauing, or are they exhilarating? Is there still a hell of a lot more to know?
Well, it's like the other sciences. The more you learn, the more you know that you don't understand anything. In fact, that's very characteristic of the sciences. Now, take a look at early modern. This is kind of like early modern science, which is instructive. So if you go back to, say, Galileo, there was a general assumption in the sciences that they sort of basically understood everything. So take something which we now know is complex but was then considered very simple. Suppose I'm holding a ball, let's say, and I suppose I'm holding a cup with boiling water in it, and it's covered. If I take the cover off the cup, the steam rises. If I let go of the cup falls. So why does the cup fall but the steam rises? Well, there was an answer that was accepted for several millennia. The Aristotelian answer. They're going to their natural place. So that explains it. Game over. So we understand everything.
It makes sense.
Galileo and others of early 17th century were willing to be puzzled by it. The ability to be puzzled by simple things is quite a significant kind of intellectual achievement. And Galileo questioned, he's the famous one, others too, why that happens. And as soon as he began to question it, it turned out not only that it's not trivial, but that one's intuitions about it are all wrong. So the sort of intuition is if you have a heavy ball and a big ball and a small ball, you know, the big one will drop faster. Okay, it turned out not to be true. They drop at the same rate. And it turned out that the rate of fall didn't depend on distance and so on and so forth. But out of that puzzlement comes modern science. And as you proceed in modern science, the more you learn, the bigger the gaps are. It's like kind of like mountain climbing. You climb a hill, you think you've made it to the top. When you get there, you see there's a bigger peak you didn't know about.
You know, over the years, I've lost count of the scientists who have sat where you're sitting and who have confidently told me that the theory of everything was just moments there. Away. Yeah. That the equation was going to go up on that blackboard at any minute.
Well, you know, physics, for example, has some slight problems, like finding 90% of the universe.
Yes.
They haven't found it yet.
Yes.
That's what the CERN accelerator's for, trying to find some particle that's supposed to be there, but if it isn't there, there's a big mystery about 90% of the mass energy in the universe.
I've had the pleasure of reading your speech for the Sydney Peace Prize while under embargo, and needless to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And let me now do a segue into this whole issue of your political life. you make the point powerfully and endlessly that we voice great moral indignation about other people's atrocities, but we are blind to our own.
That's pretty much a cultural universal, I think. When you look back over history, you find many examples of this, but very little of a willingness to sort of look into the mirror. Almost every culture I know of has a fringe of people who do it, and they're usually persecuted. So one of them drank the hemlock in classical Greece. Go to the biblical prophets, the same period, roughly. The prophets are what we would call dissident intellectuals, and they were very badly treated. One of them, a famous case, Elijah, was denounced by the evil king, the epitome of evil in the Bible, King Ahab, as proper translation should be a hater of Israel. It's usually translated troubler of Israel, you know, because he was criticizing the evil king, so he must hate Israel. The evil king, like all totalitarians, associated himself with the culture, the society, the people, and so on. And if you take a look through the biblical record, the people we honor, who were honored centuries later as prophets, were treated extremely badly. After all, one was crucified, you know. But and that's a kind of historical pattern that replicates itself through the ages. So there's typically some fringe of critics who say, look, we should look at ourselves. I mean, read the prophets. They were saying, we should pay attention to our crimes. It was put in theological terms. You know, God's going to punish us for violating his laws, but we're the ones who are sinning.
But whenever you raise this issue, you are immediately categorized as anti-American. Mind you, of course, that's the classic technique, isn't it?
Anti-American's an interesting concept. Notice that it's used almost only for the United States. So if someone in Italy, let's say, condemns Berlusconi, he's not called anti-Italian. The very concept is a totalitarian concept. It means that if you're criticizing, say, state policies, you must be opposed to the society, the culture, the tradition, and so on, which is a typical totalitarian concept. In the old Soviet Union, for example, the dissidents were condemned as what was called anti-Soviet. Mm. In the Brazilian military dictatorship, they were anti-Brazilian, you know. And it's kind of striking that I think the United States is about the only society where the term is used.
And primarily, of course, used by the right.
It's those who don't want, who I wouldn't call them totalitarian, but are reflecting a totalitarian conception that if you're a critic of the policies of the state, you must hate the country.
But you're an even-handed critic of the United States. You've never been a great enthusiast for the rabid right of the Republican Party, but you're no great fan, for example, of Obama's.
Oh, no. First of all, I think the two parties barely differ. They're just famous sociologist C. Wright Mills back in the 1950s.
What a great writer, yeah.
Two branches of the Business Party.
Yeah.
So that's not, you know, that's kind of interesting. I mean, there's a if you go to a journalism school in the United States, you're taught a concept of objectivity. Objectivity means you tell the truth about debates going on within the Beltway, you know, in the Washington framework. If you object to that framework, you're subjective, biased, you know, emotional, whatever it may be. I don't want to exaggerate it, but it has a totalitarian element to it.
Were you sympathetic to Ralph Nader's candidacies?
His campaign?
Yeah, when he ran for the presidency.
I mean, I like Nader. I think he's done very interesting things, but we had a personal sharp disagreement about this. I don't think it makes a lot of sense for an individual to set himself up and say, I'm running for president. If he was running as part of an incipient political organization which was trying to establish itself and become a voice in national affairs, say the Green Party, and he was picked as its candidate, then I think you could give some justification for it. But when it's a personal campaign, it doesn't make any sense. For one thing, it's never going to get anywhere, but it's also the wrong idea. It's not individual is going to, you know, change the world. It's popular movements can change the world. They may yield spokespersons who may be influential or significant, but they're not gods.
What do you make of the Occupy movement?
The Occupy movement?
Yeah.
I think it's quite an exciting movement. In fact, in many ways, inspiring. It's got a lot of pitfalls, a lot of problems, but it's the first organized popular response to very significant changes that have taken place in the United States, but in fact, other societies, roughly the last generation, the period of what's sometimes called neoliberal globalization, which I think has been very destructive everywhere it's been applied, the concepts, differently in different countries. But in, say, in Egypt, where the policies were applied, they led to economic growth and wealth, concentration of wealth, but very harmful to the general population and led to a lot of resistance, a lot of militant labor action, which has finally crystallized itself in, you know, the Arab Spring. If you go to a rich society like the United States, the policies were not identical, but somewhat similar in character. They've been, again, there's been economic growth, but it's gone into very few pockets. And for the majority of the population, it's been something like stagnation, even decline. That's a big shift in American history. Remember, since the 18th century, the early British colonists came, it was a developing society. It was industrializing, developing. It wasn't very pretty, I should say. It meant exterminating the indigenous population, and slavery, all sorts of horrible things, conquering half of Mexico. But fact of the matter is, whatever your judgment about the methods, it was a growing, developing society. You know, not 100%, there are setbacks. But, and it was also a hopeful society. You could expect that things are going to be better for your children. That went on until the 1970s. At that point, it reversed. It's quite a significant historical.
And it's not just the Occupy movement, it's also the Tea Party in a strange way.
The Tea Party movement is expressing similar, it's based on similar resentments and anger, but it's a totally incoherent movement. For one thing, it's not a real popular movement, it's actually quite small. There are a lot of sympathizers, but people are angry about everything. But their position is internally incoherent. In an interesting way, the United States is a very heavily polled society. We know a lot about people's opinions. When you look at the study of attitudes, which are carefully done, polls are well done often, you know, CBS, others, Pew,
Rest, yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at them, they're quite interesting. So there are studies of people who we'd think of as Tea Party adherents, people who say, you know, get the government off my back, that kind of thing. Small government, let us alone, market. If you look just at those people and you look at their attitudes, turns out they're social democrats. Like, they think, yeah, we want to get rid of the government, but what about spending on health? It should go up. Spending on education should go up. Spending on help for, say, poor women who have to take care of children, yeah, should go up. What about welfare? No, that should go down. Yeah. That's because welfare has been demonized.
Yeah. Yeah,
but even on things like foreign aid, a very standard attitude, this is a long time in the United States, is we give way too much away to the undeserving poor. Then if you ask people to estimate what they think foreign aid is, they give an estimate which is way higher than it is. When you ask them what they think it ought to be, the answer is much higher than it actually is. And in fact, across the board, what you have is these kind of vaguely unformulated, sort of roughly social democratic attitudes connected with a doctrine that says get rid of the government and hand it all over to corporations.
Yeah, yeah.
And they hate the corporations.
As well as the orthodox polls, like Pew, there are the greasy polls, which are run by, you know, the likes of Fox News. And looking at those, one is astonished from this side of the Pacific at the comings and goings in the Republican sort of rat race for the nomination. And I know a couple of days ago you were very concerned, or perhaps more amused, by the prospect of Texas Governor Rick Perry getting the nomination. Now, I know he has fallen back, but isn't it funny that the Republican machine, or the organism, can produce someone as totally irrational as Perry?
Or Backman. In fact, practically the whole of the Republican debates, I don't know if you followed them.
We do.
There's like nothing in the history of parliamentary democracy that's anything like that, I think. They are totally irrational and very dangerous. I mean, there's a kind of a catechism you have to sign on to if you want to be part of that system. And some of it is not only irrational, but extremely dangerous. For example, you have to be a global warming denier. Well, you know, that spells doom for the species.
And you've also got to deny evolution,
even at this late stage. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
About the last 30 years, the Republicans have gradually ceased becoming a traditional political party.
What are they then?
What they are is at the core, they're just an extreme faction of the very wealthy and the corporate elite, tiny corporate elite. But the point is you have to have a mass base. You can't participate in a political system if your policies are just, enrich the super rich and then empower the super powerful. You can't go to the population that way. So they had to develop a mass base. How do you do it? They appealed to some, they recognized around the early 80s that there is a mass base for that is based on precisely the kind of thing you're mentioning, kind of religious extremism, irrationality, fear of foreigners.
Fear of everything.
Everything. Yeah, that base is quite large. Mm. So, for example, in the United States, I don't know what it's like here, but in the U.S., about a third of the population believes in the literal truths of every word in the Bible. Mm. That's why you get half the population not thinking the world was created a couple thousand years ago. About two-thirds of the population expects the second coming soon, and about a third expects it in their own lifetime.
You are in a much more agnostic country, you know, Australia. We don't have these sort of manias.
I don't think any other country has it. There's been a lot of comparative studies of
different. But why America?
This goes way back. I mean, whatever the reasons are, it goes back very far. I mean, the pilgrims, the first colonists, were religious fanatics. I mean, they were waving the holy book when they were destroying
Burning
the Amalekites.
Yeah.
And then the Scotch-Irish brought similar things. Anyway, whatever the reasons may be, it perpetuated. And the Republican strategists recognized that you can appeal to that mass base and get enough votes to put into office the people who are going to cut taxes on the rich. You know.
No, given that fear is rampant in the American political system, and given that we prefer not to be fearful, do you fear for the future of your country in the short term?
Well, if you fear for the future of the country, you're fearing for the future of the world. So, for example, take, say, global warming again. That's not a joke. You look at the way it's presented is there are scientists who believe in global warming, then there's skeptics who say there isn't any. The scientists are like 98% and 2% of skeptics. But that picture is incorrect. There's another group of people who deny the scientific consensus. Those are scientists who say it's much too moderate. They say, look, it's a lot worse than you guys think. So, for example, just take MIT, where I am. There's a climate change group of very eminent scientists. They are convinced that the truth is much worse. Big study just came out from University of California, which makes the same conclusion. Even the International Energy Association has recently warned we might be getting to a tipping point where there's not much you can do.
It may be too late already.
It may be, but whatever it is, it's very serious. Now, if you have a country, the most powerful and richest country in history, which says it's not happening and furthermore we're going to make it worse, the species is in trouble. The United States is not only not, most countries, just about every country is taking some kind of maybe halting move to do something about it. The United States is going backwards. Under the impact of this right-wing republicanism, they are now dismantling the efforts that were made by Richard Nixon. That's an indication of how the country, how the party's changed. When I say it's not a political party anymore, I mean, it's developed a mass base based on fear and anger, irrationality, but it has policies which are totally destructive, and there are no longer any moderate Republicans.
I want to ask you one final question, and then you can rest your poor voice. In the Sydney Peace Prize address, you ask the big, big question, can we proceed to at least limit the scourge of war? Can we?
If you look at history, it's pretty hard to believe it. I mean, that's the UN in 1945, the founding document, and we certainly haven't limited the scourge of war. I mean, there has been one success, in fact, I mention it, and that's continental Europe. Europe, for centuries, had been the most savage, brutal place in the world. You go back to the 17th century, the 30 Years' War killed maybe a third of the population of Germany, not small. The 20th century, we know. And it stopped. It stopped in 1945, so European states don't go to war with one another anymore. There's a thesis about this in the political science literature, which I'm kind of skeptical about. It's called the thesis of the democratic peace. Democracies don't fight each other. However, there's another factor which you have to consider, and I suspect is dominant. Europeans recognized by 1945 that if they play the traditional game of slaughtering each other anymore, it's all going to be over. They've developed means of destruction so extraordinary that you just can't do it anymore. Powerful states can't go to war, so you attack the weak. And since 1945, plenty of attacks on the weak and defenseless.
Congratulations on the prize. And thanks for that marathon effort. Noam Chomsky, winner of this year's Sydney Peace Prize, driving the right-wing commentary crazy. And institutional professor and professor emeritus of linguistic and philosophy at MIT. Hallowed be his name. On our next, I'll be talking to my old friend Graham Bond, who you may know better as Auntie Jack, and we'll also be looking at how modernity has affected our attitudes and approach to death. Stick around now for the news on Radio National. See you later. Thank you.